Chapter 1. I'll read verses 12 through 18, although we'll go a good deal farther than that, I think, today. Ecclesiastes chapter 1, beginning at verse 12. I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. And I gave my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. This sore travail hath God given to the sons of men to be exercised therewith. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and vexation of spirit, or, as we've translated that otherwise, vanity and chasing after the breeze, chasing after wind. That which is crooked cannot be made straight, and that which is wanting cannot be numbered. I communed with mine own heart, saying, Lo, I am come to great estate, and have gotten more wisdom than all they that have been before me in Jerusalem. Yea, my heart had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I gave my heart to know wisdom, and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is vexation of spirit. For in much wisdom is much grief, and he that increaseth knowledge increaseth sorrow. The preacher is introducing the study that's going to occupy him for the next three paragraphs, all the way down through chapter 2, verse 23. And so he's outlining here the basic principles of his search. Those of you in academics know that you do a thesis proposal before you write your thesis. Well, here are the details of his proposal. Verses 12 through 18 are outlining the research project. We're going to see the specific report on this research project in chapter 2. But first, let's consider the proposal. You know that if you write a thesis proposal, you have to first of all qualify to do that. We've expended a good deal of prayer on people's qualifying examinations in this church. When you go to write a thesis, you take a special test to prove that you have the qualifications to do the research. Then in your thesis proposal, you have to outline the approach you're going to take. What kind of methodology are you going to use? What is the object of your study? What are you going to focus on? And it helps make your proposal more persuasive if you have some preliminary results to suggest that your methodology is good and that you're going to get some kind of interesting answer at the other end. It would be terrible to do a thesis and end up with no interesting conclusion at all. Well, this is the way this thesis proposal works. First of all, we have the writer's qualifications in verse 12. Solomon describes himself as king over Israel in Jerusalem. Solomon's domain was the largest empire ever ruled by Israel. His influence extended all the way from what we think of as modern Turkey, all up and down the Levant, the entire eastern coast of the Mediterranean Sea, all the way down into Egypt. In fact, he was the middleman. He took chariots from one end and horses from the other and put them together, and he controlled the arms market for the entire Middle East. So he was one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful, kings in the ancient Near East in his time. And he's writing from this position of supreme control. All the resources of the Near East are at his disposal. Any information that he needs anywhere, he can get. So that's his qualification. He is the king over Israel in Jerusalem. And here is his approach in verse 13. I gave my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. Now, this is not what you would call a focused research proposal. He is going to study everything that is done under heaven. You remember this phrase we discussed it last week? We're talking about things here under the sun, things under heaven. The object of his study is life on earth. We compared this with chapter 5 and verse 2. God is in heaven and thou upon earth, therefore let thy words be few. The preacher knows that there is an upstairs and a downstairs. He knows there's a heaven and an earth. At this point, he's looking at the things on earth. That is the focal point of his attention. That's the object of his study. His method is by wisdom. I gave my heart to seek and search out by wisdom. As we'll see, this includes experimental method as well as theory. He's not just going to think about the world. He's going to do experiments in it. Wisdom is intelligence with shoe leather on. We'll see more about this word as we go on through these chapters. It's very intellectual, has a great deal to do with the mind. It's associated in the Bible with literary exposure, with having read a lot, and knowing lots about what other people have said. It's not just common sense. But it does have a strong common sense side to it. It's very practical. Wisdom leads to success in life. Well, this is the approach that he's going to take, a practical, intellectual approach to study everything that is done under heaven, everything under the sun. He tells us he's going to seek and to search it out. When he says he's going to seek it, he means he's going to study it in depth. He's going to investigate in depth each of the things that he considers. And when he says he's going to search it out, that word is the one from which in modern Hebrew we have the word to be a tourist. It means to travel around throughout the countryside. He's going to survey the entire breadth of this domain of knowledge. He's going to go deep and he's going to go broad to study everything under heaven. What's his motivation? He's not going to get a degree. Hebrew University didn't exist in Jerusalem at this point. His motivation is at the end of verse 13. This sore travail hath God given to the sons of man to be exercised therewith. Man has within his heart a longing placed there by God to understand his world and the things that are in it. Solomon is exercising this longing. He's trying to give satisfaction to it by devoting himself to seek and search out by wisdom everything under the sun. Now, verses 14 and 15 give us the preliminary result on the object of his study, that is, all things that are done under the world, under the sun. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun. And here is my preliminary conclusion. Behold, all is vanity and chasing after the breeze. That which is crooked cannot be made straight. And that which is wanting cannot be numbered. The world is crooked. It's bent. Did you ever have a bent teaspoon that didn't fit in your mouth quite right and you try to straighten it out, but it just never quite comes the way it should? Or did you ever have a car in an accident and try to straighten it out and it never quite just exactly gets back the way it should be? That which is crooked cannot be made straight. That which is wanting cannot be numbered. There are things missing in this world. The numbers don't add up. We can't figure it out. What he describes here, of course, is the result of the fall. Paul tells us in Romans 8 that God has made the creation subject to vanity as a result of man's sin. And that's what the preacher finds. Now, of course, we're going to see that result repeated over and over again. This is his preliminary conclusion. It will be borne out as we proceed through the study. How about the method? He said that he was going to use wisdom to inquire about the world. Well, verses 16 through 18 give us some preliminary results about his methodology. I commune with mine own heart, saying, lo, I am come to great estate and have gotten more wisdom than all they that have been before me in Jerusalem. Yea, my heart had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. So he had the qualifications to use wisdom to study his world. I gave my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is vexation of spirit. The more he tried to bring his wisdom to bear on the world around him, the more frustrated he became. It was like chasing after the breeze. For in much wisdom is much grief, and he that increaseth knowledge increaseth sorrow. Wisdom didn't solve the dilemma that he faced. It just turned into a dilemma itself. This is what keeps the academic world going. The fact that the more sophisticated your methods become, the more questions they raise. They never give answers. In fact, if scholarship were the way to find answers, you would expect universities to slowly close their doors as the world's knowledge became known, and there it is, final result, that's it. No result is final. Wisdom never brings a final answer. It always leads to more questions. Well, let's launch into this study now in detail that he has proposed. We find it in chapter 2, and there are three main paragraphs. The first is verses 1 through 11, then 12 through 17, and then 18 through 23. And as I suggested last week, we will find that these correlate with the three things that John says constitute all that is in the world. John chapter 1, verse 1 John chapter 2, verse 16, tells us that everything in the world falls into three categories. These categories should be engraved upon the inside of your eyelids. This is what the world is about. And if you're involved in these things, you're involved in the world. All that is in the world, the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world. The lust of the flesh is a desire to satisfy bodily appetites, things like hunger and passion. The lust of the eyes is the desire for possessions, the desire to own beautiful things. The pride of life is the desire to have other people think well of us, the desire for other people to look up to us. Eve was subject to these three areas of temptation. She saw the fruit, that it was good for food, the lust of the flesh. It was pleasant to the eyes, and it was to be desired to make one wise. She could be smarter than her husband for once if she just ate that fruit. These were the areas in which the Lord Jesus was tempted by Satan at the beginning of his ministry, to turn the stones into bread and thus satisfy hunger, to worship Satan and thus receive all the kingdoms of the earth as his possession, the pride of life connected with the temptation to throw himself off the pinnacle of the temple, thus attracting a huge crowd of followers through a miraculous demonstration of God's protection. And now here we also find these same three areas, and that makes sense because Mr. Preacher has told us that he wants to study everything that is done under the sun, everything that is done upon the earth. And John tells us that all that is in the world falls into these three categories. So Mr. Preacher has done a good job in producing the outline for his research. He has done a very thorough job in covering the bases on what needs to be studied in order to form a wise assessment of everything that is done upon the earth, because everything in the world either has to do with satisfying fleshly desires, the desire of men to own things and possess things, or the desire of men to be better than other men. So in chapter 2, verses 1 through 11, he examines the lusts of the flesh. Let's see if the answer to life is found in carnal pleasures. Chapter 2, verse 1. I said in mine heart, go to now, I will prove thee with mirth. Therefore, enjoy pleasure. So we're going to study pleasure now. That sounds like fun, doesn't it? I'd like to go to a school where your objective was to study pleasure. The lab sessions are really great. Well, that's what he's doing here. He's going to have an experimental study of pleasure. And right here at the outset, he gives you a little glimpse at the conclusion. Behold, this also is vanity. It's empty. He found no meaning in it. I said of laughter, it is mad. And of mirth, what doeth it? Now, beginning in verse 3, we have the details of the examination itself, going down through verse 10. So you see in verses 1 and 2, you have the summary. First of all, 1a proposes to do the study. 1b and 2 tell us the conclusion. No hope there. And now 3 through 10 is the study in detail. Verse 11 is, again, the conclusion. We have a summary at the beginning and the details following after. Now, 3 through 10 give us his approach at the outside and in the middle the details of what he did. Verse 3, I sought in mine heart to give myself unto wine, yet acquainting mine heart with wisdom. and to lay hold on folly till I might see what was that good for the sons of men which they should do under the heaven all the days of their life. And this goes along also with 9b through 10. 9b says, also my wisdom remained with me, and whatsoever mine eyes desired I kept not from them. I withheld not my heart from any joy, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my portion of all my labor. Now, at the beginning here in verse 3 and also in 9b and 10, we see two things. The first is an utter abandon to pleasure. Gave myself unto wine. I want to lay hold on folly. Verse 10, whatever my eyes desired, I kept not from them. I withheld not my heart from any joy. Absolute surrender to pleasures. At the same time, he tries something that I find hard to believe. 3 says, I sought in mine heart to give myself unto wine, yet acquainting mine heart with wisdom. He's going to try to abandon himself to pleasure, but at the same time, not to let go of his basic methodology, which is to apply wisdom. Very intellectual study of what he's going through. So he's going to try to abandon himself to pleasure, but at the same time sort of step outside of himself and watch what's going on. And think very consciously about the experience that he's going through. Now, I don't recommend that you try this. Solomon has undertaken this, and the Spirit of God has recorded the results of his study here. Perhaps by God's strength he was able to maintain his wisdom in the midst of all the pleasures. Many people are not. They find that the pleasures sweep them away from any hope of maintaining wisdom. But we see the same thing at the end of 9. My wisdom remained with me, and whatsoever my eyes desired I kept not from them. So he's attempting to walk this very narrow tightrope. He's going to abandon himself to pleasure, but at the same time keep his wisdom tuned up real high so that he can observe the experience that he's going through. Okay, let's start having some fun. So, in verse 4, he begins to describe the various forms of satisfaction and pleasure that he went after. I made me great works. I builded me houses. I planted me vineyards. I made me gardens and orchards, and I planted trees in them of all kinds of fruits. Wouldn't that be beautiful? You have a picture here. He's got a summer house and a winter house and a spring house and a fall house. Hey, he's got a January house, a February house, a March house, an April house. Never gets bored. Different house for every season. And they're surrounded with gardens and vineyards. If you're ever hungry, you just walk out in the backyard and pluck an apple or pluck a bunch of grapes. Verse 6, I made me pools of water to water therewith the wood that bringeth forth trees. You know, it's hard to grow fruit trees in Israel because a lot of it's very arid. So he built elaborate hydraulic works, pools to collect the water in the rainy season and store it up so there'd be plenty of water there to water the trees so they'd give beautiful fruit. So now he's got this choice fruit, even when naturally it couldn't grow there because of the aridity, the dryness of the climate. And to help him with all this work, I got me servants and maidservants and had servants born in my house. He bought slaves, and they had children, and they became his slaves, so he had lots of slaves. Also, I had great possessions of great and small cattle above all that were in Jerusalem before me. Tremendous flocks and herds. I gathered me also silver and gold and the peculiar treasure of kings and of the provinces. So he enriches himself materially. Sort of like Scrooge McDuck, you know. And view him sitting here in his treasury and piling up the coins, you know, the gold coins in this pile and the silver coins in this pile. That's too high. Let's get some more gold ones over here. Pile them up till they fall down. Whoopee! Surrounding himself with wealth. I got me men singers and women singers and the delights of the sons of men as musical instruments, or probably better translated, concubines, and that of all sorts. He surrounded himself with music and sensual pleasure. So I was great and increased more than all that were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me. He's doing all of this by means of wisdom. Now we go to verse 11. Okay, experiment's over. Let's think about the conclusions. Verse 11, I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought and on the labor that I had labored to do. Now don't confuse works and labor. They're different in this book. That lamp is going to go. Works are things that you do. Works are things that you involve yourself in. Labor is that word that includes the notion of strife and toil, the real weight of the work. It's not just the activity, not the busyness of it, but the stress that it puts on you. I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought, the houses and the gardens and hiring all the servants and making sure that all the musicians keep their instruments in tune and making sure that there are strong doors to protect all the gold and silver in the treasury. Not only the works, but all the labor that he had done. Think of all the stress he has gone through to conduct this experiment. Think of the trouble it would be to do all the building and all the organizing in verses 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. Think of how many times in the midst of all this he would stop and wipe his brow and say to himself, "Boy, are we having fun yet?" Swamped in this work. Why is he working so hard? So he can have fun? So he can have pleasure? And he finally says, "Behold, all was vanity and vexation of spirit, and there was no profit under the sun." It just wasn't worth it. When you start to think about how hard people work to have fun. You often see bumper stickers that say that. Are we having fun yet? It really captures the spirit of our age. We break our backs to have a good time, and then we try to persuade ourselves that we really are happy. That's because we haven't managed to keep on that tightrope that Solomon managed to keep on. You see, he was able to give himself to pleasure and at the same time to acquaint his heart with wisdom. And when he got to the end of that whole process, he said, "Forget it, folks. It just isn't worth it. I am worn out having a good time." So, pleasure, lust of the flesh, there is no real satisfaction there. Certainly there was some transient happiness, but it didn't really satisfy. It just gave him more work and more travail. Okay, well, let's go on now to the pride of life. Maybe we'll find satisfaction there. Verse 12 gives us the prologue to this particular investigation. I turned myself to behold wisdom and madness and folly. These are the objects of his study. Wisdom is applied intelligence, the exercise of the intellect in successful living. In Solomon's life, we see wisdom manifested in his decision about the baby that the two women wanted to keep. His cleverness in saying, "Okay, split it in half and give half to each woman," realizing, of course, that the true mother would rather surrender the child than see it sacrificed. The Bible describes his activity in scientific scholarship. He knew all the plants. He knew all the animals. And his literary activity, the proverbs that he wrote. So we're talking here about the kind of thing that we would call intellectual activity today. And yet it's intellectual activity applied to practical living, applied intelligence. You're not wise if you're dumb. You're also not wise if you're an absent-minded professor. Wisdom is both practical ability and smarts. And Solomon had them both. So he's going to study wisdom. Maybe that's where satisfaction lies. At the same time, in order to have a complete study, he's also going to give attention to madness and folly, which are the other side of wisdom. Madness is uncontrolled behavior. This is what David feigned before the Philistines when he drooled on his beard and got them to consider him a madman. Now that may be just the effects of illness, old age, some kind of a disease. But folly is far more sinister. Folly implies some sort of conscious rebellion against God, willful wickedness, departing from his instructions. So you have wisdom, and then two kinds of opposites to wisdom. That which is sort of unavailable, unavoidable, madness, and that which is a manifestation of wickedness, folly. His motive for this is in the end of verse 12. The verse is a little bit complicated. King James has made an attempt to translate it this way. What can the man do that cometh after the king, even that which hath been already done? But notice the italics sprouting up. When you start seeing italics sprouting, you've got a hunch that something is difficult going on. I would suggest a slightly different translation. Drop out the italics. What man comes after the king? And then the last part of the phrase modifies the first one. With respect to that which has already been done. What man comes after the king in respect to that which has already been done? The king here is Solomon. That which has already been done refers to Solomon's life and career, in particular the very, very penetrating wisdom that he has brought to bear on the world around him. And he's saying here, I'm giving my attention now to wisdom and madness and folly, for who could possibly come after me that could compete with me in any way in these areas? Who could be better qualified than I am to carry out such an investigation? I will study wisdom and madness and folly, for who is the man coming after the king that can possibly compare with the things that have already been done? There isn't any. I'm the best qualified, so I better do the job. Now that may sound to you like a rather proud statement for Solomon to make. I'm going to do this study because nobody could possibly do it better than I can. But remember for a moment that his wisdom was not something that he acquired by his own efforts, or at least not alone by his own efforts. It was a gift that God gave him. He knew that. He recognized that he needed wisdom. He prayed to God for it, and God gave him that wisdom. Now he has this gift from God, this wisdom, and he's accountable to use it in a way that's responsible. If he did not use this God-given wisdom to study out the things that would help God's people, he would be delinquent. The basic principle underlying Solomon's statement in verse 12 is that we consider the notion of spiritual gifts. If you have a gift from God, you don't really have an option about letting it sit in a closet. The church recognizes you're enabling in a given area. You have a responsibility to discharge that ministry on behalf of God's people. Because if God has enabled you, that means that he has not enabled others, and they need the help that you have to give. So rather than seeing this as a statement of pride on Solomon's part, I think we can recognize here a healthy attitude. I'm going to give myself to study wisdom and madness and folly because God has made me an expert in those areas, and it would be a fault for me not to study them out. No one after me is going to be able to do as good a job as I am in analyzing this particular area of human endeavor. His conclusion is in verses 13 through 17. First of all, he tells us what wisdom can do. And then he tells us what wisdom cannot do. What can wisdom do? Verses 13 and the first half of 14. Then I saw that wisdom excelleth folly as far as light excelleth darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walketh in darkness. Now this is what wisdom can do. This is the first result, first conclusion that he reaches. Wisdom is better than folly. In fact, it conveys a benefit. The phrase here, it is better than folly, in Hebrew is, there is a benefit or a profit to wisdom over folly. We've talked about profit before. The advantage that something conveys. Well, there is an advantage to wisdom. Because someone who has wisdom can see where he's going. He's got eyes in his head. He can see the difficulties in the world around him. He can guide his way around the pitfalls. The fool, the man who does not have wisdom, It's like someone walking in the dark, stumbling and tripping at every corner. And he's not being cynical here. This is a real advantage of wisdom. You'll see it repeated in the book. Chapter 7, verse 2, verse 12, rather. Wisdom is a defense, and money is a defense. But the excellency of knowledge is that wisdom giveth life to them that have it. See, wisdom is the defense. It protects you. Money protects you too, but wisdom is better because it conveys life. Or chapter 10, verse 10. If the iron be blunt, and he do not whet or sharpen the edge, then must he put to more strength. This is going back to the previous verse, which is talking about chopping logs. But wisdom, he says, is profitable to direct. Wisdom is worthwhile. There is a value to wisdom. It directs you. It guides you. So that's what wisdom can do. It can guide you. It can help you to see the dangers in life and work your way around them. Remember what wisdom is here. Applied intelligence. Be as smart as you can and as practical as you can, and you'll avoid a lot of trouble. But there's something that wisdom cannot do. And that's what verses 14b and 15 tell us. In fact, all the way down to 17. Wisdom cannot guarantee you freedom from fate. There are weird little quirks that happen in life. And the same quirks that happen to the wise man happen to the foolish man. 14b. I myself perceived also that one event or happening happeneth to them all. Then said I in my heart, as it happeneth to the fool, so it happeneth even to me. So three times in English, four times in Hebrew here, you have words that mean happen or happening. A lot of emphasis for one little word. What does that mean? To happen. Something happened to me at work today. What do we mean when we say that? If I get in the car in the morning and turn the key, do I say, guess what happened? The car started. No, I don't say that. I expect that to. I get in the car, I turn the key, it starts. It's supposed to be that way. Things that happen to us are things that are sort of unexpected. Things that, from our perspective, are accidental or random. Now, as Christians, we know that nothing is random. And we'll see that Solomon knows that too. He says that later on quite clearly. But we're talking here about our perception of our daily life. Things happen. Accidents. What we call chance. Unexpected. And he makes some observations about these happenings. 14b. One happening happens to them all, to the fool as well as to the wise. The same things that happen to fools happen to wise. Now, that's not to say that wise men don't escape a lot of problems that fools get into. They do, because they are wise. But in the end, any event that a wise man ever experiences, you can find some fool somewhere who has experienced it. And any problem that fools experience, you will find some wise man somewhere who has experienced it. You cannot distinguish fools from wise on the basis of the things that happen to them. You might improve your chances by being wise, but you can't guarantee immunity from the happenings of daily life. Thus, in verse 15a, I said in my heart, as it happeneth to the fool, so it happeneth even to me. Why was I then more wise? Why did God give me this special wisdom? Why did I even ask for it? I thought this was going to get me out of lots of trouble. I thought it was going to guarantee me smooth sailing. Nope. I had the same problems that everybody else has. Then I said in my heart that this also is vanity. It's emptiness. Wisdom. Well, it can do some things, but it can't do everything. And thus, you're not going to find any lasting satisfaction in being wise. Here are the data on which he bases his conclusion in verse 16. Two observations. Four, that's the reason. You see, verse 15 is the conclusions. No difference between the wise and the foolish. Verse 16 gives the reason for those conclusions. For, first reason, there is no remembrance of the wise man, of the wise, more than of the fool forever. Seeing that which now is, in the days to come, shall all be forgotten. Wise men don't get remembered any more than fools do. We talked about this business of being remembered last week. Challenge you to remember people 500 or 1,000 years ago. And I guess it was a conversation that Ryan had with his folks about Marco Polo. We remember him. He was from a long time ago. Was he a wise man or was he a fool? Was he remembered because he was wise? Was he remembered because he was a fool? Was he remembered because he was remembered? That's all. It was an accident. Sure, we do know a few people. You know, Hammurabi, the Babylonian king. Why? Because somebody happened to dig up a big stone that has his laws on it. And they hadn't happened to dig up that big basalt pillar. We'd never know him. It wasn't his wisdom or his folly that caused him to be remembered. It was an accident, a happening. Think of the people that we remember. There are righteous people among them, people like John Wesley, and very wicked people among them, people like Hitler. Are they remembered because they are wise or because they are foolish? Does righteousness give you more of a remembrance than wickedness? No. You know, there were thousands and thousands of thousands of Christians in the first century who were far more righteous and far wiser than Judas Iscariot. We don't know their names. That's his first observation. Wisdom does not give you an advantage in remembrance. It doesn't let your memory live on in any special way. And the second piece of data to support the conclusion of verse 15 comes at the end of verse 16. How dieth the wise man as the fool? Sooner or later, they both die. The wise man eventually ends his life. He dies. The fool, he dies too. Wisdom cannot guarantee fame. It cannot save you from death. It can do lots of things, but it can't do those things. Thus, ultimately, the same things happen both to the wise and to the fool. Here's the result. Verse 17. Therefore, I hated life. Wisdom would seem to be the most promising thing. In fact, if you read the book of Proverbs, over and over and over again, it extols the values of wisdom. If Solomon had anything that he would like to hang on to and say, this is where satisfaction can be found in life, it would be wisdom. And now that has been taken away from him. As a result, I hated life because the work that is wrought under the sun is grievous unto me. For all is vanity and vexation of spirit. Does that sound pessimistic? I hated life. Does that sound ungodly, maybe? Doesn't sound like rejoicing in the Lord, does it? I hated life because the work that is wrought under the sun is grievous unto me. Talk about looking on the dark side all the time. I hated life with respect to the things that are wrought under the sun. Turn with me to John chapter 12 and verse 25. It amazes me that just when I think Kohelet is being his most pessimistic and his most ungodly, I find him articulating an idea that is echoed precisely in the New Testament. John chapter 12, verse 25. He that loveth his life shall lose it. He that hateth his life in this world shall keep it unto life eternal. Kohelet says he hates his life with respect to the things that are done under the sun. In other words, Kohelet says, I hated life under the sun. I hated life in this world. And that's exactly what the Lord Jesus Christ commands us to do. We are to hate life under the sun. We are to hate our lives in this world. Paul says it this way in Colossians chapter 3. Set your affection on things above, not on things on the earth, for you are dead and your life is hid with Christ in God. The New Testament teaches us that we are to hate our present life. Because we've died to it. We're dead in Christ. And if we needed a philosophical justification for hating it, we have only to turn to Qoheleth, because he has already proven 1,000 years before Christ that this present life is worthless. He has already seen through the sham and all the tinsel, and he says, look, we're a fallen race. We're sinful. Life is gone, folks. It's wiped up. There's no good to it. And our only appropriate response is to hate life under the sun. That's not an ungodly conclusion. In fact, that's the only way that we're going to love our heavenly life in a proper way, if we really and truly hate the life that we live under the sun. Not hate it so as to walk around distrusting God. Not hate it being long in the face. We need the trust in God to cope with this life. We'll see that Qoheleth knew that too. But in the bottom line, we have to recognize this present life is sinful, it is fallen, and our attitude toward it should not be one of saying, isn't this great, let's have a good time. It should be one of hatred, and far preferring our life to come with God in heaven. Now we'll stop there. Next week, Lord willing, we'll take a look at his examination of the lust of the eyes, and then we'll go on to see how he turns his attention from life under the sun to what God can offer to those who trust in him. I suggest that we sing in closing number 172 in our hymnal, which is, I know, one of Ron's favorites. Years I spent in vanity and pride. That's what Qoheleth has been describing to us. Vanity and pride and deliverance from it. 172 in the hymnal.